thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking today about a new documentary produced in Milwaukee that explores civil rights in the 1960s and the Black resistance. An amazing documentary. It's called American Reckoning. And our first guest is Yoruba Richen, who is co-director and co-producer, along with Brad Lichtenstein, of the film. It showcases rarely seen footage filmed more than 50 years ago in Natchez, Mississippi. And it also follows the search for justice in the 1967 murder of NAACP leader Waller Jackson Sr. Maybe you've seen American Reckoning. What do you hope can come from a documentary like this? Questions for Yoruba Richen. I hope you'll join in. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. I watched the documentary, and welcome, by the way, Yoruba Richen, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry.
I watched it, the documentary last night. It's an amazing, amazing piece. Thank you so much for creating it for us. Where did the idea come from to create it in the first place?
Well, unfortunately, Brad Lichtenstein is not able to join us right now. Maybe he'll come in a little bit later. But it really originated with him and his relationship with Congressman Lewis. He had known Congressman Lewis for a long time, had volunteered for his campaign when he was a young person who grew up in Atlanta. And they maintained a lifelong friendship. And they were talking at one point about different ideas for a documentary, looking at, you know, different parts of Congressman Lewis's experience in the civil rights movement. And somebody in his office pointed him to the Emmett Till list that Congressman Lewis had championed and that had been passed to reinvestigate cases, civil rights cases that had been unsolved. And he, Brad, looked at the list and looked at the various victims of these murders and came across Warless Jackson, his name and his story. And he soon found out that that there was a film called Black Natchez that had chronicled this time period leading up to Warless's murder, and told the story, you know, very vividly in the archive footage. And so he honed in on Warless's story, and then, you know, met his children and created a relationship, and that's how it started. And then I came onto the film in a few years later, in 2016, as a co-director.
Well, it's some absolutely amazing footage, and very clean footage too. And I was just absolutely amazed at how clear and the footage was. And I imagine there was, as you look through it, I'm sure there were pieces maybe you would have liked to use that weren't as clean to use, but maybe comment on that.
Well, there is a lot of footage, as you can imagine.
Oh.
And we created a relationship with the Amasad Research Center, which had all of the footage of Black Natchez. And not only the footage of Black Natchez, but the outtakes that were not used in the film. And in fact, the filmmakers, David Newman and Ed Pincus, had gone back to Natchez after Warless's murder and started filming again in anticipation of another film that they were going to make, and it never was made. So we also had access to that footage as well. And, you know, it is beautiful footage. There's so much in there. And of course, you know, we had to make choices about what, you know, what we could, which stories we could tell.
And it was great to have to be able to have folks who lived it, children and so forth, to be able to that added so much to the film. And what a great job of interviewing or teasing out or getting that the information that's so important to be heard and seen by others.
Absolutely. I mean, having the some of the folks who were in the footage who are still with us or who were with us when we filmed, like Dip Lewis from the Deacons for Defense, yeah. James Stokes, and of course the funeral footage where we saw a young Warless Daxon Jr. And his siblings, at that, that heart-wrenching funeral of their father, and, who are, who we interviewed obviously extensively for the film.
You know, I was, I'm old enough to have been living in that time of the 60s for sure. And it's almost astounding to me to know that that kind of existence existed for people anywhere, let alone in the United States. Maybe travel back to the 60s with us just a bit. What was it like for a black person living in Natchez, Mississippi, and what rights did people have?
Well, I was born a little bit after that time period, but, as we know, as many of us know, especially African-Americans, but many, Americans know, this was a time when African-Americans were living, were fighting for their rights, had been fighting for their rights, and lived under situations in places like Mississippi, but other places too, and not just the South, where the Klan was openly, fragrantly, flagrantly, exerting their power and causing terror on Black communities who had to defend themselves in order to survive, who had to put their lives on the line, like Warless did, in order to gain, rights that were being denied. So, but it was also as Warless said, it was a close-knit community. It was a loving community. And part of, that armed defense, armed resistance was out of a love for our community, that we were not going to, that Black people were not going to submit to terror, and were going to raise our families and going to progress. And I think that's what you see in the film.
Yeah. Tony in Milwaukee has a comment. Let's go there. Tony, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I lived through the 60s. I was really young, living in Milwaukee near Menominee Valley. And during the fair housing marches across the 16th Street Viaduct. And it's just a shame that we've made progress, but we backslided, or we're inching backwards, or maybe taking yards and miles backwards, gutting the Voters' Rights Act and not passing the John Lewis Voting Rights Act and the continued redlining of communities and the continued ignorance towards our history, towards African Americans, including slavery into Jim Crow and then beyond Jim Crow. And I think we're moving back towards Jim Crow, and also the genocide of our Native American brothers and sisters and stealing their land. And they're continuing to fight these days because people are still stealing their land and their property. And the Mexican Americans in the Southwest that were,
want to get in. Thank you so much, Tony. I want to give Yoruba a chance to comment on your comments. Appreciate it.
Well, I think what Tony brings up is that, we're really seeing a slide backwards in so many ways. He mentioned the voting rights. And also, you know, the telling of our history. There are parts, many parts in this country where they're trying to ban the truth about our history as Americans, not just Black Americans, as Americans, but, you know, ban history that makes people feel, quote unquote, uncomfortable. It's kind of insane. And what kind of country does that, that doesn't want to understand who we are, who, what our past is, and how we can all create and work for a better future? So it's pretty alarming what's happening in our country right now.
Thanks so much for that call. Appreciate it. You could join in too, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. You mentioned a couple, but who are the most significant Black activists in that region back then?
Well,
Warless was up there.
Warless was up there, but, you know, he was a foot soldier in the fight for civil rights. He was a, and there were many Warlesses all over the country. You know, the deacons, obviously, who were protecting the Black community and who were enforcing the boycott that eventually brought the white business business infrastructure to its knees. And they were able to make some real gains in terms of integration that they were fighting for. These were men who, you know, decided that they would no longer you know, be subject to white terror. They had to protect their families. Charles Evers, of course, as head of the NAACP, he was leading the charge, around, you know, the demands that the community was making, and his, and the women that were on the line. We see Jesse Bernard, the secretary of the NAACP, who talked about, you know, who was out there, you know, she was doing the work. She was fighting for women to be recognized. And then there's the younger folks who came in, who people like Dory Ladner and Bill Ware. He's the one who is on the in the scene where he tells the community that the their demands are being rejected. They were working for rights and for in the struggle in Natchez at the time. So there are a lot of people, you know, movements don't just, even though we sort of tend to have, you know, just deify one person, movements really come from the ground up and come from people on all different, you know, putting pressure from all different sides. And you know, that's definitely what happened in Natchez.
Yoruba Richin, co-director, co-creator of the documentary American Reckoning, an amazing film. I'm Larry Mueller, and Tyler Ditter is our engineer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Talking today about the new documentary titled American Reckoning with one of its creators, Yoruba Richin. She created it along with Brad Lichtenstein, and we're visiting about the film and about the time, those times back in the 60s. And I hope you all have a chance to take a look at this film. It's a very powerful film. And we, you know what? I think let's play up. We have a powerful clip, I think, that might be appropriate right at this moment, featuring a Black activist, Fannie Lou Hamer, of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. Let's listen to that.
We are sick and tired. We are going through being bit by dogs. Some of them being shot down. Some of them being beat in jail. We are not fighting back, but we're going on because there's nothing right here.
Yeah, she maybe talk a bit more about Fannie Lou Hamer.
Well, Fannie Lou Hamer was an amazing activist in Mississippi who was created the co-creator of the Freedom Democratic Party, Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And there's a famous clip of hers where she, I think it's in the mid-50s, where she is demanded to be seated at the Democratic National Convention. Their concern, she's of the Freedom Party, which, you know, was a party that was advocating for For African Americans' rights, for voting rights, for rural people to have a say in the Democratic Party. But there's actually a documentary that has recently come out. I believe it's either come out or is about to come out about Fannie Lou Hamer on PBS, on American Reframe. So people should check that out. That tells the story. It's the first feature-length documentary, I believe, about her.
And, of course, a key piece to the documentary, and Wallace Jackson's already been mentioned here, but his murder is terrible. But maybe talk more about who he was. You mentioned him, but maybe more about who he was and his influence on the Black community.
Yeah, so Wallace was a father and a husband, and he had five children, and he was a family man. But he also was a returning Korean War veteran, and he became a member, an officer in the NAACP to fight for his community's rights and for the Black community's rights in Natchez. And he worked with the Deacons for Defense, on protecting the community. His children say he was a stoic man. What really strikes me is that he really tried to shield them from the violence that was going on and to protect them. And he also took the job at Armstrong Tire Plant, took the promotion. He worked there and took a promotion in order to provide for his family. And that was a job that had never been held by a Black person. It was considered a white man's job. And that was kind of the sort of tip of the iceberg of why he was killed. The Armstrong Tire Plant was full of KKK members. And that was kind of the last straw. So he, someone who sacrificed his life for his family and for his community. And, as I said, there are many Wallace Jacksons throughout the South, throughout the country. His story is one of them, but they're names that we don't know, that we often don't get to hear. And so, with American Reckoning, with our film, we are really elevating his work and his sacrifice.
Yeah. In the film, you spoke with Wallace's daughter, Denise Ford Jackson, and we have a clip of her remembering, from your film, remembering his death back in 1967.
When the explosion happened, I was in the kitchen, and you can hear all the sirens. You could see the lights.
My mom, when she heard that sound, she said, "That's your dad, that's Jackson." Before she could finish saying it, they were knocking on the door, letting her know that was my dad.
Obviously a horrible tragedy for anyone to go through. We know there was an explosion, but maybe talk what exactly happened. Oh, I think we're...
Yes, sorry about that.
I think you're muted. That's okay.
As I said, Wallace had was a member of the NAACP, was an officer in the NAACP. He worked with the Deacons. I don't want to reveal too much about the film, but yeah. The previous president of the NAACP there was an assassination attempt on his life, George Metcalf, who Wallace worked with. Mr. Metcalf survived, but they both worked at Armstrong Tire Plant. Wallace drove Mr. Metcalf to and from work, as out of loyalty. And even though, it was putting himself even in more danger because Mr. Metcalf, they had tried to kill him. And after Wallace took the job, the promotion that I mentioned, he became a marked man. And they put a bomb under his truck and had it, you know, time for when he would make a turn into his community, and he was killed. And Warless, his son, was the one who heard the explosion and who went down on his bicycle to find, you know, that his father had been killed.
Yeah, it was a very strong piece in there with the son now at his age sort of reliving or walking the path that he took on his bike to find his father. And there are some other parts of that. Obviously, we won't go into all of it here because I want people to be able to see it. How, by the way, how can people view the film?
So you can go to pbs.org/frontline, and it's on the website. And then you can also just Google American Reckoning and YouTube, and it's on YouTube.
It's a wonderful piece, and I'm hoping that we'll be going to other programming now, but I'm hoping that we will be able to get your co-creator on the show a bit later on, Brad Lichtenstein. But in the meantime, thank you so much, Yoruba, for spending a little time with us today. It's much appreciated, and you have an amazing documentary. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. Really appreciate being here.
Yoruba Richin co-directed, co-wrote, co-produced the new documentary, American Reckoning. And just to mention, for this afternoon, I wanted to put in a little plug for more analysis about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I hope you'll stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon on Central Time, a Marquette University expert on Eastern Europe breaks down the latest developments. We'll put on today's events in context and take your questions. And I'm just finding out, you know, this is live radio. And so I'm now finding out that the program is, the break has been delayed a bit. So we are not cutting away to that. And I guess we will have to go back to our programming with Yoruba, who is also left. So we'll get, hopefully we'll be able to get her back. And I'm told now that President Biden will be speaking at 12:30. Let's take a short break. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We are talking about the documentary film American Reckoning. And our guest now, the co-creator of the documentary, Brad Lichtenstein. It showcases rarely seen footage filmed more than 50 years ago in Natchez, Mississippi. It also follows the search for justice in the 1967 murder of NAACP leader Wallace Jackson Sr. You may have seen American Reckoning already. What do you hope to, can come from a documentary like this? I hope you'll call in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Brad Lichtenstein, welcome to the show. Thank you for spending time to be with us.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've been listening to you for a long time, so it's fun to be on.
Well, it's great to have you with us. And we talked a little bit with Yoruba about how the documentary came to be, but I want to hear it from your perspective. Give us the background from your perspective on how that documentary came to be.
Sure. Now, you'll just have to let me know if I'm repeating anything that Yoruba already said. For me, it began really in 2014. And I don't know if she told you, but I had the great fortune of meeting John Lewis, the late Congressman Lewis, when I was a kid, when I was 15 years old, growing up in Atlanta. And we had a lifelong friendship. So in 2014, we were talking about some different film ideas to do together. And in his office, Brenda Jones, his press secretary, told me about the cases that were going to be reexamined under, or meant to be reexamined under, the Emmett Till Act, which Mr. Lewis had introduced and passed. So that's really where my attention started to focus on the Emmett Till Act. And then when I realized that one of the cases was in Natchez and that there had been a film, Black Natchez, I started to inquire, was there footage that Ed Pincus might have shot that wasn't in the film, the outtakes? And there was a lot of it, like 75 hours. And then I discovered that he returned in 1967, right after the bombing of Mr. Jackson. And so we knew that we had this, amazing opportunity to tell a story like this, using footage that is not like normal archival footage. It's not news coverage. It's super intimate, character driven, tells the story of the Deacons for Defense, brings to light this story from the civil rights movement era that a lot of people don't know about. It was just an enormous opportunity.
It must have been something to have to go through go through all of that footage. And I imagine you went through every foot of it.
We did. I got to say, it actually, we're used to that. Yoruba and I both have made a lot of cinema verite style films where you typically shoot 300, 400 hours even. I have a football movie that just premiered at Doc NYC and is playing festivals called Messwood, where we filmed a football season and went home with kids and we had so many hours. So actually, American Reckoning, a bit of a relief. our editor was really gobsmacked by the footage. The ability to cut together footage that is this verite style from over 50 years ago is almost unheard of. I mean, I love documentary. I'm trying to think of any documentary that I've seen that has that, has that kind of treasure trove to draw from. I really can't think of very many. Maybe one that was made by Apple Shop years ago, Stranger with a Camera, where they used their own footage that they filmed back in the 60s in Appalachia to tell the story of the murder of one of the members of the film collective. I know that's a little obscure as a reference, but, I'm a documentary nerd, so...
Well, you know what? I want to. John Lewis is featured in the film, and since you knew him, what was a little sidetrack here, perhaps? But what was John Lewis like?
Oh man, you know, Mr. Lewis was, I mean, first of all, he's the inspiration that so many people know. You know, personally, he the most, you know, when we were filming in Mississippi together with him, and I think that was 2016 for this movie, you know, he, during our break, he went out and wanted to antique shop. There's some antique stores, furniture stores, and that's kind of his jam. And then, you know, and he always made time for anybody who wanted to talk with him. I was also, you know, his wife, Lillian, who passed away, gosh, it's about 6 years now. And when my wife and I were first dating, Lillian had to meet my wife and give the seal of approval before I was allowed to move forward. So, you know, he's a avid art collector, particularly of black art. There, you know, Jacob Lawrence is in his collection. If you ever went to his office, you know, you would see so many treasured photographs on the walls. And one item that always stood out was a book created right around the time of the Montgomery bus boycott that showcases the story and turns Dr. King into sort of Rosa Parks. I think I have that right. You know, he was at once a regular guy. I mean, we ordered takeout Chinese when I was interning for him years ago and ate at his apartment. And at the same time, he is as I said, you know, the conscience of
he's an amazing, amazing person. You know, we're having a little trouble right now, Brad, with your line. So I think we're going to try and do something about that. We'll keep you on hold here a bit. Yeah, and probably go to maybe to the telephone to handle it. So let's do that now. And just to remind everybody, Brad Lichtenstein is co-creator along with Yoruba Richen of the documentary American Reckoning. I had a chance to view it last night, and it was it's an amazing, amazing film. The people in it, the story that is told is something that I think I wish everyone could have a chance to see. And I hope you'll join in. Were you around during that time period? You have some thoughts about the civil rights movement? You can join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. You can join in with your questions and comments or maybe your own experiences. What experiences did do you remember from that time period, or what experiences were you told by family members about that time period? So again, the number 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Brad, I think we got you back here.
Hello?
Hi, we got you back. And I'm hoping...
Hello, Tyler?
Oh, we're still having some trouble. So I think we're having some trouble with Brad being able to hear us. So we'll get that fixed in just a minute. And I will remind you again to give us a call, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Okay, Brad, are we hearing you now?
I think you're hearing me. Can you hear me okay?
Thumbs up. And I can hear you and I can see you. Thank you so much for that.
Of course.
When we were talking with Yoruba earlier, we talked about a number of things. But we were at the point in the film where we played a little clip from Warless's daughter, Denise Jackson, just remembering his Warless's death back in 1967. It was obviously a horrible tragedy for anyone to go through. And there was an explosion, of course, and Yoruba talked about that as well, described that a little bit. But how did people react to Warless Jackson's death?
You mean back at the time?
Yes.
Well, it sort of had a number of reactions. First of all, the Black community of Natchez was outraged and, of course, saddened. And there were massive demonstrations right after. And you see some of that footage actually in the movie, starting with the funeral and then Charles Evers, the brother of Medgar Evers, who had come to Natchez and helped lead protests and the boycott in 65, returned. And, there were people who lined up outside of Armstrong, Tire and Rubber, where many of the Klan members, including those who most believe are responsible for his death, worked, and where Warless worked. And they were pointing out people who they believed to be Klan members to the police. At the same time, J.T. Robinson, who was the police chief, perhaps feeling guilty that he had not solved the bombing of George Metcalf, who was Warless's friend and co-leader of the NAACP, and maybe also feeling like a bad for having complied in sending people to Parchman Prison where they were tortured during the protests and the boycott, was getting in front of the community and trying to say that they had good relationships, Black and white, and that they were going to do everything they could to solve the murder. Now, he never did. So that was talk. At the same time, a lot of the white community, some of the white community didn't even know, really, except for as a vague news story. In fact, people have told Denise recently, since the documentary came out, that they didn't really know this story. And there was also a lot of despair. The Deacons for Defense had, already proven their worth and, value to the community by protecting protesters and enforcing the boycott. But then here was another act of violence. And so there was a lot of despair and a sense of helplessness. And then, of course, the family and the relatives. I mean, Cheryl Glover, who is Willis's niece, and she's in the film, but we didn't use this part of her interview, but she tells the story that, she left. Many people just left because they felt like it just wasn't safe to live in Natchez.
Amazing. And you mentioned the Deacons of Defense, and we did not get into that with Yoruba. Mm-hmm. So that's well worth talking about. Who were the Deacons of Defense that stood up to the KKK?
Sure. So the full name is the Deacons for Defense and Justice. And the Deacons were a group of armed resistance, Black armed resistors, in the community, who actually the group started in Jonesboro, Louisiana, in the response to police violence in either 64 or 65, and then spread. There was a chapter in Bogalusa, and then after the bombing of George Metcalf, a lot of this is in the film, so folks who haven't seen it will learn a lot. But after the bombing of Metcalf, a group of men. And you actually see a swearing-in ceremony. A group of men who wanted to defend their community came together, and eventually a lot of the men in that swearing-in ceremony that we see will get in a car. They drive to Bogalusa. They get guns. They learn about the techniques of the Deacons. They come back to Natchez, and they really put up a resistance to the Klan and the violence of the Klan. And they also protect protesters, stationing themselves on rooftops and elsewhere, And not just the guns, but also communications. And then also, very importantly, they enforce the boycott, which was so successful it became a model throughout the state of Mississippi. And in that boycott, they enforced it by making sure that Black people didn't shop in white stores. And this boycott ended up winning the community their demands. There were 12 demands, things like, you know, access to public amenities, integrating the schools, having Black police officers on the force. So that all, you know, was part of what the Deacons were responsible for down in Natchez.
And it was interesting to me. I mean, they really were kind of enforcing people, you know, telling people, you know, don't go into that store.
Oh yeah, with force.
Yeah, yeah, and it was hugely successful. It was very interesting. They had all these 12 points that were originally ignored or turned down or just simply told, no, we're not going to do that.
Absolutely. No, the boycott arose because the white power structure was not willing to make changes. And so, you know, as one of the Deacons, James Stokes, says in the movie, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, but if you take money out of the white man's pocket, then, you know, you can force him to change. And that's exactly what they had to do.
And there's an amazing little piece in the film where I think it was the mayor started trying to come up with a reasoning for why they now suddenly are accepting the 12 points.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's Mayor Nasser, interesting in his own right, a Lebanese-American mayor in Natchez, Mississippi, who, you know, tried to sugarcoat the acquiescence to the demands. I think he says something like, you know, I wouldn't so much call them concessions as, you know, coming together and reaching consensus. So it's a lot of politico speak for sure, which, you know, hasn't changed, probably has always been the case, maybe since Greek and Roman times. Who knows?
Brad Lichtenstein, our guest today, co-creator of the new documentary, is titled American Reckoning. I hope you have a chance to see it. Questions for him or comments about those times, I hope you'll join in as well. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And Terry from Roberts did send us an email and wants to know how to view the film. We mentioned it, but it's certainly we should be mentioning it more often. So tell us that, Brad.
Sure, sure. Well, it's streaming now, both at the pbs.org/frontline website and also on YouTube, which is easy. You just go to YouTube and type in American Reckoning documentary. If you only type in American Reckoning, you'll have to choose between us and Bon Jovi, who has a song. But if you add documentary, you'll get the film.
And we've just been talking about the Deacons for Defense on the sort of on the other side of the coin, I guess we could call it, is the Silver Dollar Club.
Yes. So the Silver Dollar Group was a group of Klan members who are journalists in the film. Stanley Nelson, who is a Pulitzer Prize nominated journalist operating out of a 4-person shop down in Faraday, Louisiana, and did a lot of the reporting, including surfacing the Silver Dollar Group. These were, as he termed it, sort of the all-star team of the Klan. They were people who did not want to bother with all of the ceremony and rules for mayhem and violence. They just wanted to eliminate people who they considered to be enemies. And they are the people who most signs point to staged the unsuccessful assassination attempt at George Metcalf, the president of the NAACP, with the car bombing. And then in particular, Red Glover is the person that most people who have studied this, including, you know, people at the FBI who didn't have enough evidence to indict, but who say all roads led to Red Glover. We actually have in the film, you hear from one of the FBI agents who's no longer with us who worked this case. Red Glover was the head of the Silver Dollar Group. And the thing about the Silver Dollar Group that is why the name is that members were given a silver dollar with their birth date on it. And as one of the children of the Silver Dollar Group members, one of the Klan members tells us, go into a restaurant and a member would put the silver dollar down on a table and say, does that have a familiar ring to it? And the answer was supposed to be, yeah, it sounds like freedom. So they were, you know, they were a terrorist cell operating in and around Natchez. For those who don't know the geography, Natchez is right on the Mississippi River, on the Mississippi side, so the east side. Across the river is Louisiana. That's where Vidalia is the first town. Faraday is the next town. And a lot of the men in the Silver Dollar Group actually lived in Louisiana, but the people they were targeting were in Natchez.
So an amazing story. And Emmett Till fits into this story as well.
Right. Well, Emmett Till is, of course, the inspiration for the Emmett Till Act. And for those who don't know, Emmett Till was a boy who was said to have whistled at a white woman and then lynched by a white mob as a result. And his mother, Mamie Till, decided to have an open casket funeral for the world to see so that they could see the results of white terror. And this was in the 1950s. I want to say 1955, but I don't want to get it wrong. So correct me if I'm wrong. And that really was an important moment that sort of marks the civil rights movement's birth, in a sense, if you want to point to something, you know, as a milestone. And so Emmett Till's name is the name that Mr. Lewis gave to this act. And there's actually a scene in the film, a more contemporary scene, when Wurlis's children are at a gathering of with other people whose family members had been also murdered by white terrorists. And they're at the Civil Rights Museum in Atlanta. And one of the members of the Till family says, you know, and again, I'm paraphrasing, that, you know, we can't sweep these things under the rug and pretend this is just history. In fact, you know, such action would just give permission for us to continue to do that today. And today, you know, we're in a world where just this week, you know, three men were convicted, thankfully, of federal hate crimes, and also, of course, in a criminal court for the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. But, you know, we are seeing so much racially motivated violence today, and you really have to ask yourself how much has changed, which, of course, leads us to this question, too, of, you know, the debate over history and teaching history that makes certain people uncomfortable. I mean, that's a very poignant part, I think, of the film, because the community of Natchez had actually created for itself, for the purposes of tourism, a narrative that really whitewashes all of this history in favor of an antebellum history that is part of that narrative that fuels tourism. And they're starting to reckon with it now. You know, in fact, the mayor and I talked at an event very recently about efforts like marking Black history monuments throughout the city. You know, so they're taking steps. But, yeah. So I'm sorry I went on a long tangent from Emmett Till, but there you go. Live radio.
Well, it's live radio. Lots of things going on today. Brad, I can, as you well know, with the Russian invasion of the Ukraine, things have kind of put the world on topsy-turvy, and Wisconsin Public Radio and National Public Radio are doing the best that they can to provide us information about about that. And boy, I really want to thank you for jumping in and taking time to be with us today to talk about American Reckoning. I watched it last night, just my jaw dropped. I was old enough to live through that time, the 60s, and so it was in fact a really tough time for any of us to realize that something like that could actually have happened in your own lifetime.
Well, and that's a little bit of my point, is that if you kind of look around, it's still happening.
Yeah.
And that it's not ancient history. You know, it's people who are alive today.
Thank you, Brad. Appreciate it very much. Brad Lichtenstein, the co-creator of American Reckoning. We're going to take a break for the news. There's a coming up afternoon, we'll take a look at navigating the logistics of mental health care. It can be hard, and our next guest will shed some light on how to receive quality care for yourself or a loved one. So I hope you can stay tuned for that. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.